Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to this special episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be speaking to the actors from the hit play Red, Alfred Molina and Alfred Enoch. I'm Sam Howlett and joining me this week, a man who's very well read. He was born ready for this podcast.
Oh no.
I was hoping he'd wear his red hat today, but he isn't, so this doesn't work.
Do I even own a red hat?
Yeah, it's like an orangey red.
Oh, that one. That's a nice hat. Yeah, I know that hat.
Jake
Cunningham. More of a burnt umber, probably.
Maroon? Is it maroony?
No, it's not maroon.
Is it lighter than maroon?
Yeah, definitely. No.
Okay.
No. That's embarrassing for you.
It's
not maroon at all. So we were lucky enough to see this play a few months ago.
We were.
And it was a real treat, actually.
It's a really great play. So Alfred Molina plays Mark Rothko as he's being commissioned by a very fancy restaurant to paint...
The Seagram.
The Seagram, that's it. Mm. To do this collection of red paintings. And he meets his fictional assistant, played by Alfred Enoch. And it's about their relationship and also sort of about... Because it's Mark Rothko sort of at the end of his career, just as sort of pop art is starting to take hold and his sort of abstract expressionism is kind of starting to feel a bit old and he's not really sure where he stands as an artist anymore.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting one-act play and it's going to be shown in cinemas, a recording of the play on November the 7th.
Yeah, really encourage people to check that out.
Yeah.
And although Alfred Molina is the big draw in this, I think Alfred Enoch is actually really brilliant in it. People might recognise him as Dean Thomas from the Harry Potter films. And man, he has been hit in the gym.
Yeah, he's pretty hench in this.
Yeah, and he's our gateway into... Yeah. Into Rothko's world. The start of the play is almost like this. Enoch's almost writing an essay about Rothko, the way that he talks about him, and it's like how a first year art student might just like adore someone and write 3,000 words on them, and that's what initially I felt like the play might be. It's just an hour and a half of telling us how great Rothko is, but then it delves into some really interesting stuff and contradictions about him and his work. I totally got swept up in it.
And Alfred Molina's he's been playing this role for years now. He played it when it was in London, then New York, then back in London, so it's quite a long journey for him playing this role, and I think he said it's one of the best, as you'll hear, one of the best roles he's ever been given. So Alfred Molina, of course you know him from the first scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, Spider-Man 2, Roger and Val have just got in, the BBC Two series with Dawn French.
Yeah.
The Prince of Persia. He's in the best scene in Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much well covered, Molina.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. People know who he is.
So without further ado then, here is me talking to the Alfreds, Alfred Molina and Alfred Enoch. We're delighted to welcome to the Curzon podcast the two Alfreds, Alfred Enoch and Alfred Molina. Thank you for being
here. Thanks for having us.
So we're here to talk about Red, which as we record is due to finish in a matter of days.
Yes.
The 28th, I believe, of July. So I saw the play last night, loved it, really enjoyed it. And I was with my friend, and the first thing we thought was when we entered...
Was that your special friend?
Not quite. when we walked in, we noticed that Alfred, you were on stage with your back to the audience. And the first thing we said to each other was, what is he thinking right now? So, Alfred, what are you thinking in those minutes when you're on stage alone?
I started off at the beginning of the run. I started off thinking I'd be like running my lines, running the speech, the first speech. looking at the painting, just running through moments in the play, you know, just to kind of stay in the play. And then, but as that became more and more sort of in my bones, as it were, as, you know, as, yeah, as the play got more and more inside, I start thinking about other things, like, you know, sort of lines in the play and what that means, and how it went the night before,
yeah,
and sort of going over. It's like a little just go always about the play in some shape, yeah, or form. You know, in reliving a moment the night before that may have not worked as well, okay, as it could have done, or, you know, so on and so forth. But I'm not, and also a little bit keeping an ear out a little bit for the audience, because,
okay,
you get a sense of what kind of crowd it's going to be. You know, yeah, audiences tend to take on a sort of collective personality, and some nights they'll be rather quiet, yeah, and studious, and other nights they'll be very chatty and noisy, and it's just, and it, and you just get a sense of where to kind of pitch it right from the start, so you're sort of, you're kind of like on top of it, you know, kind of riding that wave.
Okay, so do you both get the feeling that there's a kind of, it's a different performance each night, and do you remember specific ones over time, and some stand out to you over the others, or?
I'm always very bad at remembering even what's happening. I mean, we come off sometimes, Professor. So what do you think? Is there anything you think that, you know, we could change or something? I would go, wait, there was this bit in... No, it's gone. I was like, it's gone. It's all... It's awful.
Happens every time.
No, yeah, genuinely, every time. But, I mean, immediately after coming off, you know, yeah, you're filled with a sense of, oh, that was a good one. Or, well, right, maybe that was a little bit... It wasn't quite as tight as it might have been, or whatever. So those... That's part, in a way, of the little bit of you that continues listening out to the audience, okay, and see how things land,
yeah,
or don't.
Yeah.
Just gauging it against, yeah, what kind of an audience it is. But yeah, it's always going to be different. I mean, yeah, certainly when it's a two-hander, it's there's that much play shared between two people. You're very sensitive to little changes. Something, yeah, might come out a little bit differently for whatever reason, maybe because of the audience, because of this, because whatever it could be. And that could tilt a scene in a slightly different direction or take a new shape. And that's one of the things that's so satisfying about it. Over a 3-month run, you go finding things because of that kind of stuff. So that's what keeps it enjoyable.
Yeah, and also the fact that it's always very, because as Alfie says, because there's only two of us, we're not so much waiting for our cues as kind of listening for them, because they're going to come at you in a different way each night, you know, for all the reasons that Alfie has cited. And that keeps it really sort of fresh, I think. I mean, the first thing we do when we come off stage is we ask our stage manager what the timing was.
Right, okay.
Know, and we get a sense of how the evening is put, and it might just be a difference of a minute, you know, maybe one night is 1:30, then another night is 1:29.
Okay.
You know, but it gives us it's a good gauge for us to know whether we're on the right track and whether we've kind of hit the right sort of pace for the play.
Okay. You know? So as I mentioned earlier, it's coming to an end, but it will be shown in cinemas in November 7th. And the filming of that version hasn't happened yet. That's going to happen soon, right?
No. We're doing it over three performances.
Okay.
The two performances on Thursday and the one performance on Friday, and then during the day on Friday, we're going to do a few little kind of special shots, a few little pickups,
right,
that might help for the editing and so on. And it's so effectively the recording that the theatre, the movie audience will enjoy is essentially the same as the experience that the live audience will have. You know, it's the same time, it's in the same place. We're not doing a performance to fit the medium. We give it, this is going to be a theatrical experience.
Cool. Okay. You know? So I was going to tie those two questions together then, in that.
Well, I've sort of done it for you.
Yeah, right? You have it, yeah. But in that sense, like, it's a different performance each night, but some performances will kind of be immortalized in a way through film. I mean, will there be a different air when you're doing those performances that will be...
Well, I'm going to have my agent's phone number on the back of my costume. if that helps. You know, I thought, I'm taking advantage. Well, you know, when am I going to get a chance
right
to do that?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, great. I'll reach a bigger audience.
Yeah, and I might be holding up a headshot or two. You know,
just to work it in.
Just to keep people abreast of, you know. Well, you know, I've still got, I'm still aiming for that brass ring.
Still hungry.
You know, still hungry. Still hungry. After all these years.
So except for that, it should be more or less the same. No, it's a funny thing, because one of the nice... I guess one of the things I enjoy about like going to the theatre is this. It's kind of the ephemerality of it, right? It's there for that night. That's
is that
it,
a
and
word,
it's gone.
The ephemerality? Is that
yeah,
a word?
I think so.
Is it? Well, he'd know. He's been to Oxford. He should know.
He should know.
He should know. Exactly. Yeah. It'll be embarrassing.
Emphasis on the should.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Please no one write in with complaints about my poor vocabulary. But I mean, the notion that it's something that you experience in that moment and it's past is very... gives it something, an energy in that room, which you don't get otherwise. The curious thing, of course, is that these performances, or whichever one they end up using, or however it works, will be, as you say, preserved.
Yeah. But it will be, I mean, it'll still be, you know, I would hate your audience to go away with the idea that somehow they're going to get something that is less than or different from.
No,
it's essentially, it will be the same, it's the same performance in a sense that we're fulfilling all the requirements of the play in the same way.
Yes.
But there is, but the fact that it is being preserved in a way does make it kind of a little bit special, you know, and it's so, and I know that we'll be, no doubt, because it's going to be there for, you know, as Rothko says in the play, you know, it'll be there for all time. I'm sure we'll be on our best behaviour.
Hopefully.
We won't be adding anything ridiculous.
No. Not like usual.
No.
So but hopefully not too well.
Yeah, that red nose routine.
We're going to lose that.
Yeah, you've got to lose it.
Wow. My favourite bit.
I know.
So, Alfred, you play Mark Rothko. And he says at one point he's worried that he's going to be remembered for, like, you know, wealthy people buying his paintings to put over their nice sofas. Before the play, before you read the play, both of you, what did you know about Rothko?
Well, I knew not very much. I knew a little bit. I was aware of him. I'd seen what became known as the Seagram murals that were in Tate Britain back in the day. They're now at the Modern. I'd seen those. I didn't know very much about him. I was aware of the paintings. I'd seen them in books and things like that, but I'd never really thought about him. I was affected by the paintings. I enjoyed the paintings, but I was never really into kind of finding out about him until, you know, the chance came up to do the play, and then I started doing all the, you know, all the research and reading.
Yeah.
And the great thing about someone like Rothko is that because he was so successful in his own lifetime, there's a lot of documentation. You know, there's a great biography about him. His son wrote a book about him. He wrote books himself. You know, there's loads of material, plenty of stuff to kind of research. So then I really started getting into it, and I was very happy to do that, and it did change and enhance my understanding of him and of the work, and I have grown to love it in a different way, certainly.
Mm. Yeah, as for me, I knew very little about him. I mean, I really did. I think I'd seen one of the Colourfield paintings. There was a print of it at school or something like that. But sort of beyond that, and was sort of aware of the name, that was it.
Okay.
And really, I knew very, very little about 20th century art. So that was a big part of the work that I did going into rehearsals.
Yeah.
I sort of sat down for a month and did my research and sort of tried to educate myself about this world and the things that Ken knows very intimately that I had no idea about, which was
all the reading and the research. That's the fun part of the job. I mean, that's when like you're absolutely supremely confident. You know?
Yeah,
because nothing has gone wrong yet. You know, it's the best part of the. You know, it's like I know lots of actors who would love to make a living just rehearsing.
Right.
Yeah, just rehearse and research.
Yeah,
and then when you're ready to open, move on to another job. Yeah, like, if only you could get paid for just doing that.
Oh, I'd miss it. You know, I don't think I could manage that. As fun as it would be.
But speaking of research, like Ken is a fictional character, right? Created for the play.
Yes.
So there's nothing really apart from the script to base him on. How did you like get around that? What kind of character did you make him into?
That probably more often than not is the case when you sort of when you're playing a part. I think it's a sort of different kind of challenge when you're playing someone who existed, a historical figure, and in a way I'm sort of glad for that freedom. I mean, it gives you a lot to go on, but a good script, a good play script like Red is, like John Logan's written, has so much in it. There's so much richness there. There are lots of little directions you can go in and lots of things you can take and you can run with them and you can find things and you can build on those hints. You know, I kind of work with an actor in Spain on my year abroad who said, you know, the text is your start point and your end point. And that's completely right. Mm. So that, so everything you really, really need is there. I mean, you could, I get, you know, there's a world where you can even take on playing a historical figure and you can throw those things out and say, well, what's in the script? Mm. And I'm gonna make the choice to take some liberties otherwise. Yeah. I mean, that maybe is a contentious thing to do. But, you know, the thing you most, first and foremost, have a responsibility to is the text, I think. So that wasn't problematic in any way. That was exciting and that was part of the fun. Because it gives you a bit of freedom.
Yeah. Okay. And Alfred, was your interpretation of Rothko more steeped in research, as you were saying? Or?
Well, there was a certain amount of research. I mean, I think the as Alfred says, I mean, when you're playing a character that is fictional, that is the case most of the time, unless you make a career playing historical or contemporary figures who actually exist. But the only response, I feel that when you're playing a character that actually existed at some point, a real person, the only responsibility you have is to not misrepresent them.
Mm.
So, for instance, with Rothko, there was no point me coming into work and saying, I think I'm going to play him with an Irish accent and a limp, just because I happen to think that might be interesting. You know, I have to represent him in a way that is at least valid and accurate, as accurate as it can be.
Yeah.
Obviously, the play takes certain liberties and dramatic license here and there, but essentially, the Rothko that I'm playing is the Rothko that John Logan created. Yeah. I mean, and I did all my research and I found out, you know, he was a chain smoker. I found out the brand of whiskey that he drank. I found out all kinds of stuff about him, but all that homework is really just for my benefit.
Mm.
You know, the last thing an audience wants to pay good money for is to watch an actor dragging his homework along with him, you know, and saying, oh, you'll find this bit interesting because I did a lot of research on this. That's of no interest to anyone. You know? So you do it for your own benefit. You do it so that you've got some kind of bedrock that you can rest your creative work on. You know, but ultimately, it's what goes on between Alfie and I and the play. It's our characters. So in a sense, my Rothko is probably, as far as the theatre is concerned, is probably just as fictitious as Alfie's Ken. It's our version of it. It's not, and it doesn't pretend to be, you know, historically accurate or a piece of documentary evidence.
Okay. And so it's been nearly 10 years since you started playing Rothko.
2009 was the first production at the Donmar.
So can you talk about, why it is you've stuck with him for such a long time and why you keep coming back to him?
Well,
what is it about?
You make it sound like I've been doing this play for 9 years. Yeah,
on intermittently.
There's been lots and lots of breaks. We did it in 2009 at the Donmar. Then we went to, the following year in 2010, we went to Broadway. Then we did it in LA in 2012.
Right.
And that was the last time we did it up until now. We were hoping to do it sooner, but, you know, people's schedules got in the way.
Sure, yeah.
But living with it has been a great pleasure. I mean, it hasn't been like a burden anyway. I mean, this is the greatest part I've ever had. Mm-hmm. And this is probably the best play I've ever had the privilege to be in and work on. And it's that has been the most extraordinary experience. Plus, I've had the really unique pleasure of doing the play with three different actors, all of whom have brought something unique and special to it. And that for me has been fantastic. It's purely selfishly, because it means, you know, there's been a 50% change in cast, which means that each time we've done it, it's been a whole new play, a whole new experience, because each actor has come with his own feelings, his own desires, his own kind of take on it. And the only constants has been basically Michael and Christopher, the designer, and myself. And we always went to great lengths to make it absolutely clear. To Jonathan, when Jonathan Groff did it in LA, and when now Alfie doing it here in London, we went to great lengths to make it clear that this is your part.
Mm.
you do what you want to do with it. You know, apart from a few technical things that have to be the same, like, you know, priming the canvas and so on, the rest of it is yours. It's up for grabs, you know. So we've changed. It's been a different play. So from purely from my point of view, that's been a real joy, you know.
And how has your performance changed depending on the Ken or depending on?
Well, I think it's a matter of what you know. The one, you know, I'm going to say this in front of him because I know he gets a bit shy. But the wonderful thing about Alfie as an actor is that he doesn't wait for his cue; he listens to it. So there's been nights when I've had an idea about something and I've suddenly given him a line in a completely different way, and he responds to it. He responds to it in that moment, and that's fantastic because that's like playing. That's really, and there's only the two of us, so we absolutely rely on each other. We're not, you know, we can't hide. We can't, you know, I need him as hopefully as much as he needs me. and so there's a kind of mutual, you know, it's a mutual respect and a mutual kind of interest has developed that, you know, I'm interested to see what he's going to do tonight.
Mm.
You know, because I know it's going to be different. I know something's going to be different. There's going to be a little hint of something else. And that means I can, you know, hit the ball back, you know, in a different way. And that's what makes it. And that's why every time we've done the play, I've always missed it terribly. You know?
Yeah. And finally, I just wanted to ask, so you've both had early film roles in the first film of major franchises, so Indiana Jones and Harry Potter. I just wanted to ask if you've been exchanging stories about those experiences or...
No, we haven't actually. No, we haven't really. You know, there's been a bit of kind of, oh, you did all the Harry Potter films. Oh, you did the first Raiders of the Lost. Okay, so what's for lunch?
What's for lunch?
it hasn't been a major topic of conversation. Is that bad? Is that should it have been?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe,
you got 3 days.
We've got 3 days.
All right. It's been a pleasure, the Alfreds, Alfred Millie and Alfred Enoch. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
So thank you very much for listening to this special Red podcast. Another of our podcasts out this weekend is our Halloween special, where we talk about David Gordon Green's re-sequel of the Halloween franchise. Do check that one out. It's a very fun show.
Lots of red in that as well.
Lots of red in that as well, but not the kind of red you might like. we'll be back next week talking to Mike Lee about his latest film, Peterloo. And if you have any thoughts on Halloween or any of the films we've spoken about in the past few weeks, do let us know where we are on Twitter at Curzon Cinemas or email podcast@curzon.com. And you can find us on iTunes and Acast. Please do rate, review and subscribe if you feel the need to. So it's goodbye from Jake.
Bye-bye.
And goodbye from me. Thank you very much. See you next week.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.